Okay, tonight I'm going to talk about the Bagua as a path of healing. And I realize this might be a strange term. It's from Chinese. So this diagram shows in the center the Tai Chi Two, the diagram of the supreme ultimate. Americans just call that the yin yang. That's in the middle. And then these symbols around it are the Bagua, the eight trigrams. And so these are the eight trigrams, the Bagua. Ba just means eight. So these are the eight gua, or the eight trigrams. And in each one, the solid line represents yang, the broken lines represent yin. And so these are just various combinations of yin and yang. And these are important in the I Ching because one of these on top of the other makes a hexagram. A hexagram is six of these lines. And often the hexagram on top represents something about the outside or the appearance of the situation, and the hexagram on the trigram on the bottom represents something about the interior of the situation. So for example, this is a hexagram with heaven on top, pure yang on top, and then pure yin on the bottom. And so if this were a person, this would be someone who on the outside was very forceful and very, pushy and strong opinions. Let me tell you how it is. But they would be completely in the dark inside. And this one is called standstill, because a person like that usually doesn't make a lot of progress in the world. By contrast, this one, earth on top, heaven on the bottom, this one would represent somebody who on the outside is yielding, polite, happy, never makes a fuss, goes with the flow, but on the inside they know the way of heaven. So this is much more the image, say, of a Taoist sage. There are these classical ideas that made the title of the movie, The Crouching Tiger, The Hidden Dragon, the idea that any old person going to the market might really be a sage and you'd never know until the moment arrived. This one, incidentally, is called peace, because someone like this creates a tremendous amount of peace in the world. And so that's a little bit how the trigrams are used in the I Ching. And this is kind of a strange diagram. This shows the trigrams again. It's actually from the Ritzema and Karcher book. And it also, it, there's a lot on this diagram. There's a lot going on here. But it also shows the five elements: wood, fire, earth, metal, and water. And these are strangely correlated in some ways with these hexagrams. And this order is particular. Fire controls wood because fire consumes wood. Earth controls fire because earth can put out a fire. Metal controls the earth because metal plows the earth. Water controls metal because water can wear away and rust metal. And wood controls water because wood can suck up water. So they have this interlocking relationship, these five elements, and it's correlated in some ways with the hexagrams. And so this particular order of the hexagrams that I showed earlier is quite significant. It's called the later heaven order. And this is what Confucius has to say about it. This is a very paradoxical passage I'm going to share. Oh, wait, I'm not going to share that passage yet, I guess. So I'm going to talk about the individual hexagrams first. Okay, I forgot about the order of this slideshow. So the first one, Jun, arousing. This represents thunder, and this has a real shocking, destabilizing quality. It stirs things up. And what you have to remember is that this is something unusual. When we think about thunder in the West, we think of it as coming down from the sky. We have this tradition of thunder gods like Jupiter or Thor, and they're up in the sky throwing down thunderbolts. Indra, also in India, is someone in the sky throwing down thunderbolts. Well, in China, In traditional China, they conceptualize thunder as something rising from the earth. And from the point of view of physics, it really doesn't matter. I mean, both stories are kind of true because you're connecting a circuit and it doesn't matter which way you say it's flowing. But it's just, it's funny. It's a very different way of thinking about thunder. Thunder comes up from the earth. So it's an incredibly ungrounding kind of force, potentially. The second hexagram in this order is wind, or the gentle. It represents wind, it represents wood. It has that a quality of sort of a quiet perseverance, you know, the way that wind, you know, over the course of years, over the course of centuries, will shape a landscape. And it might not be apparent to the observer at any one moment how powerful the wind is, but over time, it has tremendous effects. The way that wood very slowly will push up and grow through things, that sort of thing. Yes, and so there's a lot of movement associated with this hexagram. It's more of a gentle movement. The third one, Li, the clinging, this represents fire. And it also represents anything having to do with light or consciousness, awareness. There's a strong association of congregating, of people gathering together, sort of the way that, say, a campfire draws people around it, you know, that kind of thing, the drawing power of fire. And then this one is pure yin. It's the earth. And so it's incredibly, it's yielding, it's receptive, tremendous qualities of just allowing and letting be, tremendous qualities of serving and sustaining. This one represents a lake. And it's a symbol of joy, joyousness. It's very open. There's a connotation of words being spoken, you know, words that stimulate and open possibilities up. This one is pure yang, the creative. It has a quality of tremendous strength and this almost unwearied perseverance. You know, say the way that the sun and the moon just continue in their cycles constantly. The moon never gets tired of going around the earth. It just keeps going and going, you know. It's like that kind of energy, that energy of just unwearied perseverance continuing to move. The abysmal. This represents water, and in particular, it represents water in the sense of, say, water falling into a gorge. It has a real quality of danger, a quality of, it's really a very strong expression of, you might say, the watery quality of life in general. Everything that is in flow, everything that is, that's sort of an uncontrollable flow that you can't stop. You just have to go with the flow or you'll drown, this sort of thing. And it sort of wipes out and levels anything in its path. And finally, keeping still, the mountain. And this is just an incredible, forms an incredible boundary in a way, the way that mountains form a boundary between geographic areas. And it just is incredible stopping, energy of stopping and energy of stillness. And so this ends the cycle very appropriately because it's about making a stop. And so this, again, this order is the, what is sometimes called the later heaven order, the order that represents life in our world as opposed to, say, what life might be in an ideal world. And I believe now we have the long quote from Confucius describing this order. And so this is a paradoxical quote when you hear it at first. God comes forth in the sign of the arousing. He brings all things to completion in the sign of the gentle. He causes creatures to perceive one another in the size of the sign of the clinging. He causes them to serve one another in the sign of the joyous. sign of the receptive, sorry. He gives them joy in the sign of the joyous. He battles in the sign of the creative. He toils in the sign of the abysmal. He brings them to perfection in the sign of keeping still. This is in the translation by Richard Wilhelm. And so what's going on with this? This is a passage I've meditated on for years, and I really think that it speaks to a path of healing that goes through these hexagrams. And this is what I'm going to try to explain. How is this a path of healing? And so I have a few different translations of each verse. God comes forth in the sign of the arousing, and the sound of the arousing is thunder, is this shock quality. And this first statement is a very deep archetype that plays out in so many ways. If we think of the classical Buddhist story, of Prince Siddhartha, he lived in the lap of luxury. And then at a certain point, he saw the four sights, and the four sights acted as a shock, as really the, you might say, the sign of the arousing. The four sights were, he saw a sick man, then he saw an old man, then he saw a dead man. And so those first three exposed him to the realities of sickness, age, and death, which were not part of his world before that. And so he was completely shocked and disillusioned by that. And then the fourth day he saw a monk and decided that's what he wanted to do with his life. And he left his palace and went off to be a spiritual renunciant. And of course, that path that he set out on ultimately led to the Bo tree, led to his enlightenment, and led to the religion we know as Buddhism. He became enlightened and taught the religion we now know as Buddhism. And so in a very powerful way, God comes forth in the sign of the arousing. Similarly, you might say that in Christianity, the cross represents an incredible shock, you know, the absolute scandal that the God-man was killed in this most vicious way. And in the very classical understanding, it's the cross that brings about the redemption. So again, God comes forth in the sign of the arousing. Trauma often has the quality of this shock. Trauma is the stimulus that comes too much, too fast, too soon, and it overwhelms us. And it's almost the nature of trauma that even if we experienced trauma years ago, decades ago, there's a way that is still timeless within us because there are still places that are arrested, that are stuck because of that trauma. And often when we're feeling stuck in life, we're wondering why are these same patterns? Why am I stuck in this pattern year after year? It's because there's some trauma underneath that we need to address. And so this first stage, you might say, is about getting in touch with the reality of the trauma. Sometimes that comes because the trauma is re-triggered by, you know, current circumstances re-trigger a much older trauma within me, and then it becomes present to me again in this shock. And it's hard not to be overwhelmed by that shock, you know. There's a great verse in the I Ching. So in the I Ching, there are, of the 64 hexagrams, 8 of the hexagrams are hexagrams that are the same trigram over itself. And so the hexagram thunder over thunder, it has words to the effect that the thunder shocks people 100 miles around, and there are people who are laughing, there are people who are afraid, and so all these kinds of giddiness. But the sage does not drop the sacred chalice. And that whole idea of remaining in composure in the face of shock, that's sort of a high moral idea that the I Ching holds up here. So once we face the shock, what happens? And then the translations here are really odd. Wilhelm says he brings them to completion in the sign of the gentle. Master Wang says concerted in the sign, and Ritz says arranging. And so you might say this is sort of the first step of dealing with trauma when we're trying to make sense of things, when we're trying to arrange what are the patterns, what are the threads. you know, the first step when we're really dealing with trauma. And there's a gentle quality to this. It's incredibly gentle. It's about going very slow, sorting out, you know, where does this thread go? Where does that thread go? How does this issue connect to that issue? Sort of making sense, almost cataloging, you know, all the effects of the trauma as it's landed in our lives. And then the next squaw is about radiance. He causes people to see, or causes his manifestation. And this is the dawn of understanding. And often this comes, you know, this squaw has the connotation of people congregating together, groups of people coming together. Often at this stage in dealing with trauma, it's incredibly helpful to find other people who have been through a similar kind of trauma, to be in some sort of support group, or maybe to find a therapist, a group, maybe a group led by a therapist, where you're actually talking and making meaning in conversation with one another, seeing each other, being seen, trusting what you're experiencing because you hear it in somebody else, this sort of thing. All that is contained in this particular gua. And then the next stage, once we start to understand, we have to enter this deep allowing. And so the translations talk about service. I would say allowing is a very good word to think about this here. It's absolutely necessary to relate to a wounded part of us in a way in which we're offering allowing. You know, if we think about any of our think about an external relationship, you know, it would not be a good way to start a friendship to say, I'm going to require you to be this way, or I'm going to require you to follow certain rules. Like, no one wants that. You know, a friend is someone who allows you to be who you are, you know. And much in the same way, these broken places within us, which are desperate for connection, need to feel allowed to be who they are. And this is one of the trickiest things with trauma, because when it's something with trauma, you know, the natural tendency of ego is to be hurt, to want to push it away. I don't want to feel that. I don't want to, you know, or I don't want to deal with it if it's going to show up this way, you know. And it's so hard just to allow these wounded places to speak in their own voice. And that's really the wisdom of this gua, to allow everything to be as it is, to speak in its own voice, to come forth as it needs to come forth, as it seeks connection. Now, if we're able to do that, we get to this joyous place. And this joyous place is associated a lot with words. And I'd say this is the stage of the healing where we really get it, where we understand and we can talk the talk. We can't walk the walk yet, but we can talk the talk, you know? I've been at this stage. I remember many times in the cycle of healing coming to this stage, and boy, I can talk it through and through, but I can't actually live it out, you know. And you know, in this word drunk, head centered culture that we live in, words are given so much value. Sometimes people are fooled in thinking that when they get to the point where they can talk about it, they've reached the end of the healing process, you know, and this sequence makes very clear, you know, this is an important step, but this is not the end of the process. So what do we need to get beyond this stage? We need the power of heaven. And all the translations are using this imagery of battling or striving. The way I would formulate this is the strength of a spiritual warrior, the discipline of a spiritual warrior, someone who is disciplined to do the work of facing the trauma, of doing the work to expand the container, doing it as a practice. And now whether this is a meditation practice or a journaling practice or a yoga practice, something where the practice is happening every single day. Every single day we're going back to it with this incredible determination, focusing on it again and again and again. And again, we live in a, how can we say, we live in an instant gratification culture. You know, if it doesn't feel good, we don't want to do it, or, you know, we'll stick with it for a while, but not when it gets too uncomfortable, that sort of thing. And of course, when we do that, we short circuit the healing process. You know, we only heal to a certain extent. We don't heal all the way. And it really takes this discipline to have this unwearied perseverance of just returning to it again and again. And if we can return to it again and again, then we're able to drop in. And this is about the toil. This is really the most difficult part of the healing process, where we're dropping down deep and sitting with the raw pain itself. And just sitting with it, allowing it to be, just accepting it for what it is, loving it for what it is, until it shifts. And the miracle of mindfulness is that when we truly love and accept any part of us for what it is, then that part can shift and open and become more tender. And so this is a very powerful place. And how can I say, this is really the place where we're dissolving a lot of the stuckness that we've been experiencing in our surface life. And then finally, the last stage, this ends in stillness. When we've cleared so much that I can just sit in stillness with that, then I've integrated it fully. And then I hold it with a kind of power. So now I've integrated that lesson fully, and I can live that lesson out in my life. You know, and that ability, you know, the ability to hold it in stillness means that now it's mine and I can walk through the world with it. And so that would truly be the end of the healing process. And so I'm going to escape from this and I'll share the quote sheet. Is there a way I can put this in the chat maybe? Well, actually, tell you what, we'll stop the sharing now. So, at the top of the quote sheet, I have the quote from Confucius. Under Jun, I have the quote that I alluded to from Hexagram 51. Shock brings success. Shock comes. Uh-oh. Laughing words. Ha-ha. The shock terrifies for 100 miles around, and one does not let fall the sacred spoon and chalice. So again, this incredible composure that the sage has in the face of shock. And another way to say, you know, God comes forth in the sign of the arousing is the lovely quote from Rumi. The wound is the place where the light enters you. For the gentle, I won't read that whole quote, but the gist of it is the power of the ongoing gradual progress of the gentle, the gradual progress of wind, the gradual progress of wood. And along with that, a quote from Emily Dickinson: the truth dazzles gradually, or else the world would be blind. From Lee, the clinging about light and fire and the clinging power of that. And really about the power of sharing in general, of bringing things to light with others. As Brené Brown says, if we can share our story with someone who responds with empathy and understanding, shame can't survive. And so there's this incredible power of sharing in a healing context. Under the receptive, first, a quote from Keats: let us open our leaves like a flower and be passive and receptive. From that very receptive psychologist, Carl Rogers: the curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. Tara Brock says: call on your natural curiosity as you focus inward. Try to let go of any preconceived ideas and instead listen in a kind, receptive way to your body and heart. And Veronica Togoleva says, Authenticity is not the search for uniqueness. An oak tree does not try to become an oak tree. A cactus does not try to become a cactus. All living things simply reach for nourishment. They reach for the sun, they reach for water, they reach their roots deeper into the ground. By being open to receiving what they need, they become unique effortlessly. So let yourself fall open. Forget about crafting yourself a unique personality. Just allow. Allow in love. Allow pain. Allow desire. Allow learning. Allow healing. Allow frustration. Allow uncertainty. Allow yourself to experience what you must experience and learn what you need to learn so that your uniqueness can emerge organically. Incredible wisdom in her words. From the joyous, a quote from the I Ching about the power of joy, and also this interesting quote from Joe Abercrombie, get what you can with words, because words are free. Words are not the whole story, but, you know, do what you can with words. From the creative, Reshma Menakin, who has a great deal to say about healing, says, to me, self-discipline is love. Your ability to have some self-discipline around what it takes for you to have a sense that you're whole, good, and that you matter is about having the self-discipline to take care of yourself daily and giving yourself what you need consistently every day, even when you don't feel like it, to do that daily. Dr. Angela Lee Duckworth says, grit is passion and perseverance for very long-term goals. Grit is having stamina. Grit is sticking with your future day in and day out, not just for the week, not just for the month, but for years, and working really hard to make that future reality. Grit is like living life like it's a marathon, not a sprint. For the abysmal, or danger, this wonderful idea from David White, where he's talking about a Vajrapani figure in a Buddhist temple, and he says the spear of this figure is the right kind of peril, the right kind of danger you're supposed to put yourself into when you're willing and generous enough to let go of whatever ideas you had about yourself or your life beforehand. You're willing to scare yourself a little. The invitation is worth frighting yourself a little. And just this whole idea of what's the right kind of danger to face, you know? Marion Woodman, the great Jungian psychologist, said, body work must be approached with the same respect and attention that one gives the dreams. The body has a wisdom of its own. However slowly and circuitously that wisdom manifests, once it is experienced, it is a foundation, a basis of knowing that gives confidence and total support to the ego. To reach that wisdom requires absolute concentration, dropping the mind into the body, breathing into whatever is ready to be released, and allowing the process of expression until the negative, damned energy is out, making room for positive energy, genuine light to flood in. And just this, another idea from Reshma Menakin, practice is controlled failure. You know, we just do our practice again and again, you know, and there's no guarantee that it's going to be spectacular. In a way, we're practicing to fail. We're practicing to hold this brokenness. From a little bit from the I Ching, from Keeping Still, also a quote from the Taoist sage Zhuangzi, men cannot see their reflections in running water, but only in still water. Only that which is itself still can still the seekers of stillness. If water derives its lucidity from stillness, how much more the faculties of the mind? The mind of the sage, being in repose, becomes a mirror of the universe. Hermann Hesse says, within you there is a stillness and a sanctuary to which you can retreat any time and be yourself. And Eckhart Tolle said, you are the stillness beneath the mental noise.